from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Margaret Atwood's big apocalyptic trilogy began with the novel Oryx and Crake. It tells the story of an all-too-imaginable world of ruin brought low, of bioengineered beasts, and a new strain of engineered humanoids moving in, designed to feel no sexual jealousy, to eat nothing but leaves. Now she's out with the final installment, the origin story of a new age, almost without us. This hour, On Point, Margaret Atwood, The End of the World and a New Human Race. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you been there since Oryx and Crake? And what do you make of Margaret Atwood's vision? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me now in the studio is Margaret Atwood, novelist, poet, literary critic, essayist, and environmental activist, big thinker in what she calls speculative fiction, author of the novels The Handmaid's Tale and the Booker Prize winner The Blind Assassin, among others. In 2003, she published what would become the beginning of her big post-apocalyptic trilogy called Oryx and Crake. She followed in 2009 with The Year of the Flood. Now she's out with the final installment in the trilogy, Mad Adam. Margaret Atwood, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you right here in the studio.
Lovely to be here.
So maybe the thing to do, you have so many readers and followers, but not all will have clicked into this great big trilogy. For readers of Mad Adam, you've got a little summary of where this trilogy's been before the third piece. I wonder if you'd read just at least from the top to get us started, to get us focused on the world you've created, perhaps will create, I hope not.
Let us hope not. It's a book.
Yes.
So I did a little summary because I always love it when people writing several books give me a little summary. So I did that. And it begins like this, Oryx and Crake. As the story begins, Snowman is living in a tree by the seashore. He believes he is the last true human being left alive after a lethal pandemic has swept the planet. Nearby live the children of Crake, a gentle humanoid species bioengineered by the brilliant Crake, Snowman's one-time best friend and rival, for he's his beloved, the beautiful and enigmatic Oryx. The Crakers are free from sexual jealousy, greed, clothing, and the need for insect repellent and animal protein. All the factors Crake believed had caused not only the misery of the human race, but also the degradation of the planet. The Crakers mate seasonally when parts of them turn blue. Crake tried to rid them of symbolic thinking and music, but they have an eerie singing style all their own and have developed a religion with Crake as their creator, Oryx as mistress of the animals, and Snowman as their reluctant prophet. It is he who has led them out of the high-tech paradise dome where they were made to their present home beside the ocean. In his pre-plague life, Snowman was Jimmy. His world was divided into the compounds, fortified corporations containing the technocrat elite that controlled society through their collective security arm, the Corpse Corps, and the plebeians outside compound walls where the rest of the society lived, shopped, and scammed in their slums, their suburbs, and their malls. Jimmy's early childhood was spent at Organ Inc. Farms, where his father was working on the pigoons, transgenic pigs with human material designed for transplants, including kidneys and brain tissue. Later, his father was transferred to Healthwiser, a health and wellness corp. It was at the Healthwiser High School that adolescent Jimmy first met Crake, then known as Glenn. They bonded over internet porn and complex online games. Among these was Extinctathon, run by the cryptic identity Mad Adam. Adam named the living animals, Mad Adam names the dead ones. They learned to access Mad Adam via a chat room accessible only to trusted grandmasters of the game.
And there's Margaret Atwood reading from the story so far at the beginning of her latest in the trilogy, Mad Adam. It's a lot to read, but I wanted to give people a sense of the sort of a complexly built out vision of a dystopic, post-apocalyptic and pre- and post-apocalyptic world that you've created, and to see how many of its elements tie right back into our world right now. It is not hard to recognize our lives today as the pre-path for the world you lay out there. This isn't thousands of years from now. This you make sound around the corner.
We've got the tools. Now, it was a little bit harder to recognize in 2003 when the first one came out, but since that time, some of the things that were theoretical in the real world in 2003 have become actual now. And included in those are the transgenic pigs. They were working on them then, but I understand that they have now surmounted the barriers that were keeping them from being able to grow human kidneys for transplant in pigs. Hooray for you.
You write in the back of the book, although Mad Adam is a work of fiction, it does not include any technologies or bio-beings that do not already exist, are not under construction, or are not possible in theory. These pigs are not just harvesting kidneys for humans out of them. They've given them and other creatures some intelligence that takes them, yeah, that turns them into pretty menacing creatures.
Well, basically only the pigs. Only the pigs have got the
crafty
human cortex.
Yes.
The pigs are smart anyway.
Yeah,
pigs are extra smart and extra big. So big, smart, extra crafty pigs.
You lay out in the first two this sort of dystopian world, the interventions, bioengineering interventions and more that change it very dramatically, that ultimately take almost all of the humans as we know them away, that introduced this new kind of sweet human who is devoid of the characteristics that I guess you see as having pushed us into some
their
no
creator,
small difficulty.
Their creator, whose
yes.
name is Craig.
Yes.
So don't confuse me
All
with
right.
people
well,
in the book.
Yes, yes.
I'm not about to eliminate the human race. Don't worry.
but what about the list of things that Craig eliminates, the traits that he eliminates in what becomes really this successor species in your story? I mean, how does Margaret Atwood look, you know, at sexual jealousy and greed and clothing and the no animal protein and symbolic thinking? Is that the recipe for our demise?
Well, I leave it to you, but I think that built-in insect repellent would be a good thing.
No, that'd be awesome.
Not all bad. And I'd like the sunblock while we're at it.
I'm not sure most humans would throw sexual desire overboard.
No, except, I didn't say sexual
once,
desire.
Well,
no,
yes, but you do. But I'm reading here, but it only occurs once or twice a year.
Well, but when it's good, it's very, very good.
It better be once or twice a year.
Well, the rest of the time, you don't miss it.
Yeah, I mean, great, but
I can see you're not going for this.
No, I'm an old style human on that front. I'm old school, I guess. I mean, it's pretty incredible. They're very sweet and free about it. And what you've just got them when it does come around. And you've just got them eating leaves because Craig sees agriculture, not to mention the raising of livestock, as a big
not
problem.
To mention,
why?
Yes. Well, it was fine when there were few of us, but there are now a lot of us, and all of us need to eat food. So where are we going to get the food that we are going to eat? How much of the planet is arable land? What is the carrying capacity of our planet? Do we need to think of some new ways to grow food? You probably saw the lab meat hamburger that was in the news.
I did not lust for it, but I saw it.
Well, it's that again. It's not all bad because just think what it eliminates. It eliminates the methane livestock is putting into our atmosphere.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it eliminates, the animal rights people, what would they think of that? Because no animal is going to suffer in its production. No brain, no pain, as it says in Oryx and Crake about the chicky knobs, which are headless chickens that grow multiple breasts, thighs, and wings.
Yeah, yeah. And here you take us to kind of look back. Ultimately, it's looking ahead, but it's looking back in a way to think about origin stories. in these great changes you describe, there will be new understandings, new age really being born.
You know,
here.
The new people have language, and that language has got a past tense and a future tense like ours. And once you have a past tense and, say, a curious four-year-old, you're going to have, where did I come from? And then you're going to have, well, where did the stork come from? And what about before that and before that and before that? And sooner or later, you're going to have an origin story of some kind. And there is a wide selection amongst human cultures, but they've pretty much all got origin stories. So the Krakers have been asking those questions, and they now have an origin story. It may not be the absolute shocking truth, but it's something that they can live with.
It makes us think. Margaret Atwood's story takes the world kind of through the eye of a needle. Much of it does not survive. Those on the other side will see the eye of that needle as their point of origin. And from that comes a story.
Guess what? We've been there before.
We did hear about Noah and that flood, and it's maybe real-world equivalence.
It's real-world equivalence. There's an interesting book out there called The Humans Who Went Extinct. And we were reduced to a mere nub about 75,000 years ago.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist, essayist, activist Margaret Atwood about the conclusion of her big post-apocalyptic trilogy and the end almost of the world, or at least a rebirth with its own origin story. There was Oryx and Crake. There was the Year of the Flood. And now the third, Mad Adam. It's just out. I wanted to ask you that because historically, books like this are often read or have been read by us as, oh, look at this terrible future we could have. Let's not do that. Let's avoid it. Yours wade so deeply into the waters that they almost feel more like guidebooks. Here's where we're going, folks. You may now think about how you'll handle this.
Well, it's very interesting what happens when the lights go off and we find ourselves in a pre-electrical world. I was told that in the recent floods in New York, there were a lot of people heading uptown to where the lights were still on with their phones. You know, take me to my phone. Take me to a place where I can plug
the
in
juice,
my phone.
The juice.
Yeah, because they just felt lost without the ability to communicate by cell phone as they had been in the habit of doing for what, only about 10, 15, 20 years.
It wasn't enough to turn to their neighbor. They needed that thing in their hand to speak.
Well, you get over that once you figure out that it doesn't work right there and then.
The juice is gone.
It's gone. So then you have to figure out what to do next. It would, of course, be a great catastrophe for us if that juice went off very suddenly because so many of us live in cities. And those cities are fueled by cheap energy, and that is the big problem that we're looking at. How do we get the cheap energy in a way that isn't going to kill us?
What do you think of your wild or mad genius Crake's view of humanity, that it's just, its software is wrong. It's inevitably destructive to the planet.
I don't think that he's alone in thinking that. He is possibly alone in the kind of solution he's thinking of, but as it turns out, maybe not so alone after all, because have you read the most recent Dan Brown novel called Inferno?
I have not.
Some of that very same thinking is going on in that book.
That being what sort of thinking?
Too many people, too destructive. And when you go back to ancient mythology, it turns out that Zeus was thinking the very same thing before the Trojan War, not to mention God before Noah.
These stories of our flaws have been around for a long time. Maybe it's the capacity that's changed.
We've got we now have such powerful tools, and we've opened one of the biggest toy boxes in the world, which is the ability to mix and match genetic material.
It's frightening in a way to read. I mean, yours goes back a decade now to the beginning of this trilogy, but then just in the last, couple of weeks, we're reading the big technology guru at Microsoft, Nathan Myhrvold, and he's warning about bioterrorism that could take out life as we know it, and saying, "Look, this isn't science fiction. This is very real."
You know, there's a wonderful book about ancient bioweapons, which is called, I think, Scorpion Bombs and Greek Fire. So these ideas are not new, the use of natural things as weapons. And there is a huge amount of research going on, particularly into anthrax in World War I, both sides, mm-hmm. and a lot of research going on in World War II, both sides. And if you think that nobody saved any smallpox, think again. So it's not new ideas, but our methods of deployment and our sophistication, if you like, those are huge now.
Let's go to Joseph, calling from Savannah, Georgia. Joseph, you're on the air with Margaret Atwood.
Hi, Tom. Hello, Ms. Atwood.
Hello.
I have two questions, but I'd like to ask you the one I called up on first. And this is something my fellow literature and writing scholars have been wondering ever since Handmaid's Tale, which is, you write pretty much stock science fiction, and we were wondering why you insist on not calling it science fiction and disassociating yourself with the genre. I mean, the tropes are right there. I mean, for example, you're using the similarities to Childhood's End with regards to your engineered species is very strong, as are the Eloi and the time machine, and so on. I mean, so I would like to get an answer from that.
Okay, I think it's just a matter of truth and labeling. And you can get a book of mine called In Other Worlds, SF and the Human Imagination. The sad fact is that if most people hear the word science fiction, what they think of is other planets and spaceships and things that cannot happen here and now, such as time machines. And I think it's very useful to have another term that refers to the kinds of books, such as 1984, that are about things that really can happen on this planet here and now.
And may have even begun. You call it speculative fiction rather than science fiction.
Yeah, maybe we should think of another word altogether and call it, you know, Bafutsnik or something like that, so that nobody gets worried about this science fiction thing. What you get with science fiction, which is the term, by the way, that didn't come into usage at all until the end of the 1920s. H.G. Wells didn't call his stuff science fiction. Nobody did. Jules Verne didn't call his things science fiction. So this term, people get very possessive about it. They get very defensive. They get very territorial.
Joseph, do you want to pull Margaret into your sci-fi world? Is that important to you? Why does it matter if she wants to carve out a different kind of...
I'm not even carving it out. I'm just referring to it.
Yes, yes. Joe?
First of which, of course, is speculative fiction is an older term that refers to both science fiction and fantasy, and branches thereof, like the branch of fantasy, which we call magic realism. And she's perfectly correct in calling it speculative fiction.
We'll go with that agreement. Did you have a second question, Joseph?
No, he wants the science fiction to be a top heading over everything.
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah. So, and I do look forward to reading that book. I will look. I'm actually literally on my way to the library. I will look and see if I can pick it up.
Thank you.
So, the other question was, I hinted at it. Do you feel that influences like the Eloi was something that you looked at when you were creating bioengineered race?
I have a deep, deep background in 19th century utopias and dystopias, and you might like to pick up the edition of The Island of Dr. Moreau that has my introduction to it. So I talk a bit about the time machine there, but I'm very familiar with the background.
The whole great genre.
The whole great genre, and it's because I was in 19th century. I was a Victorianist, Joe, in my earlier life.
Joe, I really appreciate your call. You know, let me ask you, looking back at that history, those writers then, the ones you've named and more, and of course there was plenty that was dystopic.
Until really the end of the 19th, early 20th. The earlier ones were pretty much utopias.
Yes.
They were looking forward. They were saying, we can improve.
How
we can
amazing
be better.
It will be.
We've got all, and they were making such such progress in the 19th century, mm-hmm. both with medical science mm-hmm. and also with things like as simple as plumbing and water.
So, yes, indeed, look forward to this great, bright, beautiful tomorrow. Yeah. But when it began to turn dark in those original authors, I mean, with yours, there's such a sense that in all the different features of it, you're looking at existing or fully conceived technologies and just doing some kind of logical extension, dystopic, of where they could go. Did those earlier dystopic authors build their dystopic views off of imminent technology or off of the sense of the flaws in humanity that would lead us to dystopia?
There were two strands which give rise probably to these two branches. And one was Jules Verne, who wrote about things that he thought could really happen, mm-hmm. so submarines. And then there was H.G. Wells, who was writing about things that were obviously not going to happen anytime soon and probably never, like the time machine.
And tall, stomping invaders from other planets.
Yeah, so their orientations were quite different. You know, Jules Verne, more of the popular mechanics kind mm-hmm. of guy, what mm-hmm. we can do. Mm-hmm. H.G. Wells, who are we? And he vacillated on that quite a bit, but he was very haunted by Darwinism.
I really do
and
try
the
to
feeling that, you know, are we inherently mm-hmm. are we progressing or are we inherently kind of evil at the core?
So I take it you see yourself more in that camp, wrestling with that question.
No, I think both, really. I think we're learning more and more about...
you're not introducing spacemen into your stories.
No, not at all.
It's all kind of a human-produced nightmare.
Yeah, so in that line of descent, you can look at Jules Verne and then somebody like Orwell, somebody mm-hmm. like Huxley, Brave New World, somebody mm-hmm. like Orwell, mm-hmm. Both writing about stuff we really could be and do. Not a galaxy far, far away and in another time.
I remember reading Orwell 1984 way back in the day where, and many of these, and perhaps it was just the naivete of youth, but I always saw them as stern, even strident admonitions not to go down this road, as warnings, as cautionary tales, of course, yeah. that we would absorb and then avoid through.
Well, Orwell for sure, you know.
Yeah.
Look out for Joe Stalin, basically.
Yes, exactly. Look out and don't go there. When I read you, the tone and tack is different to my mind. I almost read as though we're already halfway into this python. We're half swallowed, and you're not writing cautionary tales, but here's how you may end up dealing with this, folks. Tales.
Well, partly that, yeah. You hear the word, adapt quite a bit these days, don't you?
Constantly, we hear it every day. We're going to adapt to mountain floods in Colorado. We're going to adapt to fires all over the place. But I mean, you know, you're already halfway to hell when the author is. It's not a cautionary tale, folks. It's a guidebook. Is that
let's
you?
Hope not.
Is that the way you see it?
Let's hope not. It's fiction. Honest.
No, come on. You know you're writing a very, very at your throat kind of warning here, though. Fiction.
Well,
it's not fantasy exactly.
Partly. But you know, one of my great people that I love very much is Jonathan Swift. Mm. And he was in the habit of writing these straight-faced total lies.
Let's eat children.
To get rid of the problems in Ireland, why don't we sell and eat babies?
Mm. Mm. Dinny's calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Dinny, you're on with Margaret Atwood. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Margaret Atwood.
Hello.
I'm just a long admirer of you, and I've read, I think, probably everything you've written, but I wanted to thank you for especially your second volume of this trilogy. There was a character in the book who was a beekeeper, and I can't remember her name because I'm not in my library, but she was so appealing that I decided that beekeeping was something I would like to start doing as a measure to combat the horrors that are going around. And help with local pollination and whatnot. So when I retired, I started keeping bees. And you didn't write about the problems that are plaguing bees, but there are a lot of problems now. But I think there are enough organic beekeepers who are trying the second wave with no treatments for mites, no pesticides, et cetera, that it's enormously satisfying, and I wanted to thank you for giving me the cue that this was something useful to do as we look around us and moan and groan about the seeming irreversibility of some of these climatic changes and genetic engineering changes. So I mostly wanted to thank you. I do have a question. Did
All
you
right.
ever keep bees? Did you keep bees, or do you have a friend who put you on to this quality of the insect and human relationship?
Okay. First of all, my father was an entomologist.
Hmm.
Second, he did his
study
early
insects.
Work
mm-hmm.
On bees, mm-hmm. not honeybees, but individual type of bee. And third, we did live on a farm for 10 years, and we did have bees on the farm. We were not solely responsible for them, but we worked with the beekeeper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I've always read a lot about social insects, and of course E.O. Wilson is another person who writes. His thing is ants, but they belong to the same they're all Hymenoptera.
You're an activist. Is it gratifying for you when you hear a reader of your books whose actual life was changed by that reading of your fiction?
I think it's quite lovely. I'm an activist by default. You know, I didn't wake up one morning and say, hey, when I grow up, I want to be an activist. I think like a lot of people, I find myself shoved into it because of the problems we face. I would much rather we didn't have those problems and that then I wouldn't feel that I had to do any of these things.
Part of the, you look at two groups, well, more than two groups. I mean, sort of rabid blind consumers are kind of the background bad guys in all these books, driving everything over a cliff. There are others who you look at more closely and with sort of mixed verdicts. And one of those groups you call God's gardeners. You describe it as followers of a green religion. And there's clearly some admiring impulse here, but there are also some cautions there about where that can go. Where do you see that? A lot of Americans on that road now. I don't know if Denny's one of them, but
I think the God's gardeners are pretty benign. And if I were living in that particular society, I would, and I had a choice between being them or somebody else in that society, I think they would be very appealing.
Just get green as can be.
Well, they're very, they're non-aggressive. They're sort of us in our good mode. They raise vegetables and bees on flat rooftops in slums. And they're led by a person called Adam One, and they've got their own hymns. They've got their own saints, including St. Robert Burns because of the mice. And
their own teachings,
and
which
their
are
own
very
teachings.
Sternly nonviolent.
They're very nonviolent, and they're vegetarians unless you get really, really hungry.
But that nonviolence in this book cuts both ways a little bit, right at
it
the beginning.
It always does.
Because it looks like there's evil and there's a chance maybe
to... Well, okay, it's that question that you always have yourself is do you step back or do you engage? I know some Mennonites, and I was talking with them about their history and how they got chased from this country to that country to this country to that country. And I said, well, why were people always kicking you out? Because you were pacifist. You weren't threatening anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, because they didn't like the model. You know, if you could say no to the army, then everybody could.
I grew up with plenty of Mennonites. Wonderful, wonderful world. Margaret Atwood is with us. Her new book is Mad Adam. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour with novelist Margaret Atwood about the conclusion of her big post-apocalypse trilogy and the end, almost, of the world. Kind of a rebirth and the origin story, fabulously told, but it doesn't seem so distantly fabulous. The last of three is Mad Adam. It follows Oryx and Crake, the year of the flood. Margaret Atwood is with me in the studio. Lots of feedback online, all kinds of digital ways in these days for you here. Amanda says she has a way of taking the worst parts of our world, combining them into one horrifying, plausible story. As frightening as these worlds seem, I can't tear myself away. Kathleen writes, although she may not be foretelling future events, she's seeing potential outcomes. What about that notion? You have a way of taking the worst parts of our world.
Well, sometimes the best. The God's Gardeners movement is, in essence, with us today, for instance. Mm-hmm. And how about that urban beekeeping?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of it going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the lady that we heard from, but people in cities are raising bees on rooftops, and those bees are quite frequently healthier than the ones out in the country subjected to the pesticides.
Why does the worst pretty much win out, though, in your works?
It doesn't always. I think it's
not always,
but
overall, this is not, these are not Gardens of Eden in general that you're describing.
You know, let me
put it to
you
this way. Is that just what it takes to make
a
compelling book, or is that your...
I was about to say, yeah, so if we get up in the morning, mm-hmm. have a nice breakfast, go to work, have fun time at our job, come home, walk the dog, have a great dinner, go to bed and do the same thing for the next 200 pages, are you going to read it?
Right.
Be frank.
Yeah, right. Eric in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Eric, you're on the air with Margaret Atwood.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's an honor to get to address you, Dr. Atwood. I just have a question about your Matt Adams trilogy as a tale of a cognitive apocalypse. I'm interested in the evolutionary emergence of language, and it seems like the story that you've created, you sort of create an opposition between what might, in sort of overly simplistic terms, be called left hemisphere abstraction and a right hemisphere sort of image emotional based situation. And you sort of juxtapose the situation between the science and technology and the humanities and academia and the sort of values that go along with these two cognitive centered cultures. And the left hemisphere culture seems to be very, in your book, your work seem to be sort of autistic. They call the people outside their culture non-specifics instead of con-specifics. And it just seems like the apocalypse is being driven by the left hemisphere abstract autistic culture.
Eric, that's a lot already. Hang on. Yeah. That's a great Margaret,
okay.
How about it?
So what he's focusing in on is in Oryx and Crake. Jimmy and Crake are two different kinds of human beings. Crake is very good at the math and science and the logic. And therefore he gets to go, when he graduates from high school, he gets to go off to the Watson Crick Institute.
Right, right.
Very well funded.
Mm-hmm.
And poor Jimmy, who's not good at those things, has to go off to the Martha Graham Academy, which is one of the few surviving liberal arts institutions.
This all sounds very familiar.
Yes, and if you look at the stats in our world today, you will find that liberal arts institutions have been declining rather precipitously, whereas the science and technology ones are very well funded indeed, because businesses put money into them, hoping that ideas will emerge from them, just as, for instance, around Stanford, that will spin out money. So that's what's driving it. It's not so much this hemisphere or that hemisphere. It's what's getting funded, because people will think it will pay off for them.
Well, you say spin out money, and no doubt that is true, but it's also framed as, well, spin out human advancement.
Yes, well, that word advancement has always somewhat given me the willies. You can read a book by Bill McKibben, which is called Enough, in which he examines some of these trends. To nobody's surprise, the scientists that think that the human race should be enhanced.
But look at the Sistine Chapel ceiling. Isn't it the glory of God, that human desire and capacity to create?
Well, let's just back up a bit here.
Yeah, okay.
I'll finish my sentence.
Oh, sorry.
The scientists interested in altering the human race would alter it in the direction of creating more men that were like them. And then this other gender of women who happen to like very smart male scientists like them.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the perfect future in their
world
view.
Yeah.
So when you say advancement, you always have to ask, who's choosing? Like, who's going to say what is an advancement and what is not?
Well, what if it is part of humanity that's choosing?
This is what I mean.
But that's part of humanity.
You mean the smart part?
or you mean the science and tech-oriented part? You could be smart and very happy with your beekeeping.
Yes, you could.
But smart and wanting to build the next iPhone, smart and wanting to look for the merger of humans and computers, you know, smart and looking for the new. Are they the exiles of your paradise? You want to make them that? Aren't they integral to our species?
What exactly are you saying?
Well, our caller says you've got some folks who are going to be your beekeepers and others who are going to be your techies,
okay,
and who will see technological advancement as advancement.
Okay, so let's
but they're part of the they're part sure, of the family.
Sure, of course. And we've always made technologies. We've over time made more and more different technologies. Mm. And if you go back to something like John Keegan's History of Warfare, you will see that process was driven by the invention of new technologies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whoever got the stirrup first had a big advantage. Then when cannons came along, the people who thought they had the best technology, namely castles, had an awful surprise.
Are you a technophobe then?
No. No, I'm in no way a technophobe. Technologies are tools. They're human tools. And every human tool ever made has got a good side, a bad side, and a stupid side.
So what do we make of your Crake in this great trilogy when he makes the designs and makes the successor species, in effect? He cuts that capacity, right out of them.
He thinks he's making an advancement.
Which is the elimination of...
Yeah, that's his
STEM
decision. Yeah.
Science, again, technology, engineering, and math.
Don't confuse me with him.
Well, no, but it is the story you tell.
Yeah, that's true. But it's the story of him. It's not the story of me. So you're asking me how
I guess then you're picking up on our widespread fear that our creations, that's the Frankenstein story, that our creations may be abominable.
And sometimes it's not the creations that are abominable, it's the uses to which the creations can be put.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go back and read the original Frankenstein, the monster himself is a kind and gentle creature, but it's the way people treat him that turns him into an avenging demon.
Toy writes and asks, please ask Margaret, if the turn from utopian to dystopian writing reflects or reflected perhaps a transition in living conditions where improvement in daily life is improved enough that any more improvements represent some sort of trade-off. We have to lose something for the further advancement, maybe.
Okay, so I think that turn came... That turn from utopia to dystopia took place for two reasons. Number one, the darker side of the Darwinian view took hold. And number two, World War I, and then the utopian experiments that were in fact tried, namely the USSR, Hitler's Germany, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Pol Pot's Cambodia and Mao's China, just to take the four most well-known examples, put people off the idea that we were so extremely perfectible and that you could suddenly impose a blueprint on everything that was going to make life so much better, except first we had to get rid of those people.
Mm-hmm.
We never actually got past the getting rid of those people moment in those experiments. Things did not become unimaginably better.
In Crake's kind of successor species, the Crakers, I was trying to figure out here as I read, does every child have more than one father, four fathers?
Every child has an unknown father.
Because every act of reproduction involves four matings.
That's right.
And who knows?
Sort of like cats.
I didn't know that about cats.
Oh, you didn't know that about cats. Well, then.
You seem very interested in this whole process.
Well, who's not? But what is his vision in having four fathers instead of one for each new child?
First of all, it's a great pun on forefathers.
Yes, it is.
Second,
the writer sits right before me.
But second, if you look at the history of the patriarchy, which came about as soon as we had agriculture and you had to therefore defend your agricultural land, and then you had to pass it on, it was inheritable, and then you got father to son, and then it became very important that it really was your son. So Craig wants to do away with all of that. He wants to do away with the House of Atreus model. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you don't know who the father is, in any way you don't have agriculture, so you don't have stuff that to pass on as an inheritance, mm-hmm. Then that whole conundrum just goes away.
Let's go to Heidi in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Heidi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
Margaret, I just wanted to thank you so much for your incredibly intelligent depiction of female artists in particular. In A Cat's Eye was my studio companion. I would listen to you and your books on tape while painting, and I was struck by the ability you had in describing her as a whole person and someone who was strong enough to look at all sides of things and really dissect it and then put it into her work in such a way that she didn't run away from things that were like unseemly or not picture postcard pretty. And that's how I want to be in my work. I try to show things from every perspective, and I don't try to think about saleability, but so much of our culture is geared towards that. And I just wanted to thank you so much for that gift and to let you know that your work is playing while I'm working, and I'm inspired by your brilliant mind.
Thank you very much.
That's wonderful, Heidi. Thank you. I mean, you do feel in your books this sort of unedited understanding of biology. What goes on, you include. And we normally omit a lot from our daily discourse. Somehow we humans, you know, we just don't include everything. We edit, leave a lot out.
Well, it's because you have to get through the day, isn't it?
Well, yes, we do. Tom in Scituate, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, it's a great pleasure to speak with Margaret Atwood. I think Oryx and Craig was an amazing achievement. And one thing I've found is that her male characters are more real and more believable than just about any author writing about another gender. And I'm wondering where that comes from.
Well, now, I'm really old. I've known a lot of male people in my life. And I used to make a joke that I grew up in an all-male household because my dad was a male, my brother was a male, and my mother was also a male. But that's a joke. She was a tomboy.
Okay.
I was the girliest person in the family.
But you were watching and listening.
Not only that. I mean, because we grew up in the woods, mm-hmm. What with the bears, et cetera, when I wanted to get my brother to play with me, we essentially had to play
boy games.
His kind of mm-hmm. game. So, yes, we played with dolls, but mm-hmm. we were lining them up in lines and then having a war with them.
Great. So it's
yes,
kind of baked in the life.
There were a few headless dolls in our life. I'm afraid it's kind of baked in. So, and, yeah, so like that. And then on through life. I, in fact, have known quite a lot of boy people, and I like to get boy people to look over the manuscript and tell me if I've made any really bad mistake. Mm. An earlier book, I got one of them to read it, thank heavens, because he said, "You cannot shave off a full beard using an electric razor." I said, oh, who knew yeah. that?
Now that you mention it, that figures.
Now that you mention it, who knew that?
Right. Let me get one more call. John in Bridgeport, Connecticut. John, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I'm Ms. Edward. Nice listening to you and talking to you. I am a happy and proud Luddite, and I have tended to avoid the whole dystopic view. However, I find it to be more, seemingly more plausible now. And I come out of that after the Great Recession, and I look around this country especially and see that there's less use and necessity for human beings, especially the numbers that we have. Our most recent function was to be consumers and consume as much as we can, but our economy doesn't seem to be able to sustain that anymore. So I'm a little concerned and alarmed that we have the ability, as you point out, to eliminate great pieces of the human race, and there seems to be less need for us, and we're more of a burden on the planet.
Just got a minute, John. Let Margaret take it right there, if we may, and thank you for your call.
What's the question?
Well, the question is, John says a dystopic outcome looks more plausible than ever.
Yeah, and I think that's why so many young people are reading books of that kind. So when I started with Oryx and Crake, it was, as it now turns out, the first of a wave.
And you've got the Hunger Games and everything else out there.
The latest wave, mm-hmm. because, of course, yes. there had been some in the mid-20th century and some in the early 20th century.
But do you have a consoling thought then for John, or just, well, watch out?
Okay, my consoling thought for John is the human race has been through bottlenecks before, and we came out of them. So we may have to call upon resourcefulness, but we have that built in.
Of course, bottlenecks mean a lot of creatures don't make it to the other side.
That is what bottlenecks mean.
Is that where we are?
Well, we are in the midst of a great wave of extinctions of other bioforms, but I don't predict the future.
Right. Margaret Atwood, the latest in her trilogy is Mad Adam. Madam, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you. Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.